Okay, welcome to session 271, Dissenting Opinions, Art from the Dark Side of Happy Valley. You can sit wherever you want. Well, we're not in Happy Valley, but we're next door. So we have three notable Mormon artists, writers, creators, to address this topic tonight.
You
cannot hear me. Is this on? Yes. Okay. I just have to speak close to the mic. I'm going to briefly introduce our authors, our panelists, and then they'll each give introductory comments, and I'll pose some questions to them, and then we'll take questions from the audience. For recording purposes, we need you to come up to this microphone here to ask any question that you want. I know people don't like to do that, but it really helps the people who are listening while they're driving across country, you know, on the tape. So, our first speaker is Brian Evanson. And Brian hit the Mormon literary world strong when his book Altman's Tongue came out. He may talk about it, but he has a famous story. He had to leave his teaching job at BYU because of his writings about the dark side of Mormonism. He for a while he was at Oklahoma University, and now he is the director of He's the director of the literary arts program at Brown University. And he's published many books since then, and lots of them deal with Mormon themes or Mormon issues or explicitly Mormon topics. And almost all of them are in the vein of his original book, Altman's Tongue, in the sense that they look at the dark side of Mormonism. Here are some of the titles. They even sound dark. Contagion. Dark Property, which has characters from the Book of Mormon in it. Father of Lies, which is about the corporation of the blood of the Lamb. And it's about a rigid and insular religious community that protects one of its own. The Wavering Knife. And he has one that's coming out this fall called The Open Curtain, which is it chronicles a vicious murder committed by a grandson of Brigham Young. And it deals with blood sacrifice. So Brian Evanson will be addressing the topic of the dark side, writing from the dark side of Mormonism. After Brian, Neil LaBute will address us. Neil LaBute's a local boy, well, not so local, but who made good in Hollywood. I first met Neil when he was at BYU writing plays that were about Mormonism and that were controversial. In fact, they let him advertise the plays on campus. Just a select group of faculty and students would be told about them, and they'd be produced. These plays are collected, and three of them are collected in a group now called Bash Latter-day Plays. And the most famous of those three is called A Gaggle of Saints, which was published in Sunstone and was performed here at Sunstone years ago. Since then, it's been performed in London and in New York. New York with Calista Flockhart starring in it. And Neil has gone on. I don't think he's written anything else explicitly about Mormonism, but you probably know some of his work. Two other plays that he wrote when he was at BYU that have been made into movies called In the Company of Men and Your Friends and Neighbors. He wrote the screenplay or co-wrote the screenplay and directed Nurse Betty and did the screen adaptation for Possession. His play In the Shape of Things was recently made into a movie. His other plays are like The Distance from Here, The Mercy Seat, Filthy Talk for Troubled Times. Like Brian Evanson, Neil likes to deal with the dark side. His characters do nasty things, and he paints them just starkly, honestly, not necessarily heroically and not necessarily pejoratively, but because of that, lots of people don't like Neil LaBute. But Maybe I'm a Pollyanna, but you know, when I leave his movies, I'm inspired. And our third person, you could almost call him the Frank Capra of Mormonism. I mean that not in a Pollyanna sense of way. Richard Dutcher seems to, in his movies, God's Army, Brigham City, and God's Army 2, States of Grace, which will be out on DVD this fall, he tries to look at Mormonism optimistically, but with an honest look at humanness. And like Frank Capra, he looks at the dark side of people inside of Mormonism, but tries to see it in a very kind, charitable, human way. You know, and I really do think he's like the Frank Capra. If you think about Frank Capra, even like in It's a Wonderful Life, you've got a guy who is contemplating suicide and is threatening to send his uncle to jail rather than himself. You know, this is a guy who has a dark side to him. And that's true in a lot of Frank Capra movies. And so Dutcher deals with the dark side of Mormonism, but in a different way than Brian or Neil. So we'll let them do their little introductory comments, and then we'll go into questions and have a fun time. Thank you.
This is very shaky up here. So if I pitch off, it'll be okay. I think I'm just going to talk for a few minutes, and I think we're all just going to talk very briefly so that there'll be time for lots of questions. I grew up in Provo, grew up in Utah Valley, and when I was growing up in Provo, I think I had a very different sense in the world, of the world, than I started to get once I began to look around a little bit. As a kid, I remember a lot of my peers being interested in watching R-rated movies if they were only violent. If there was sex in them, they weren't they felt it was inappropriate to see them, but if it was only violence, then they thought that was somehow better or okay. And that probably is where my interest in violence and my interest in the dark side started. Was just trying to think about why it might be that somehow watching someone get their head blown off on television or on a movie was more acceptable than seeing a breast. So I grew up in that culture, and one thing I found is that it was a very happy culture. Everything was on the bright side. At the same time, as you looked closer and closer, you began to see kind of rifts and pox and scars, and there were all sorts of things going on if you dug just a little bit below the surface. And so what I found is that Happy Valley was only happy as long as you were blissfully ignorant of all that was going on. And I became very interested in trying to think about the totality of what went on in the place. And what I found when I did that is it was very much like any other place, except that people really refused to acknowledge the darker elements. So when I wrote Altman's Tongue in the early 90s, I had in the back of my mind the notion that what I was trying to do was to recuperate violence. And what I mean by that is that I saw violence as something that had become something that could be very easily swallowed. It was easy to watch television and just absorb it without thinking about it. It was something that had lost its sense of threat. And I was interested in what it would take for us to see violence as something that had a kind of devastating power to it. And Altman's Tongue was an attempt to explore that. So the stories have difficult and violent situations in them. And often people are being confronted by things that they don't understand or things that they respond to oddly. And my notion was that as the characters failed to respond in ways that were positive or predictable, the reader would be put in a position where he or she had to judge what was going on, had to make sense of what they were going on. And this is something that worked very well for many readers. Other readers really resented it. And as I talked about this morning, I was teaching at Brigham Young at the time, and a student wrote an anonymous letter to a general authority, and that resulted in a kind of long process that ended up with me leaving Brigham Young after having realized that I couldn't publish what I wanted to publish while I was there. So, should I answer that? I can answer it here. Okay. So while that gives you a sense of where I'm coming from, since then I've published largely with, all my work is with national presses, and I've largely published, I've published some work that's Mormon related, some that isn't. I think that the book I have coming out in October called The Open Curtain is about William Hooper Young, grandson of Brigham Young, who ritually murdered a woman in New York, and it's about a young boy, kind of late 20th century boy's obsession with this case and how it ends up affecting his life and rearranging his life. So that's where I'm at still. I'm interested still in kind of thinking about darkness. I think as time's gone on, it's expanded. The way in which I think about literature has changed slightly. I saw Altman's Tongue as something that was kind of a corrective to the culture that I'd grown up with, and as a result it was something that was meant to be read either in connection with that culture or read as a piece of innovative fiction. There's two different ways to move through that text, I think, and one way really acknowledges the way in which it responds to a lot of contemporary fiction. And so I've always had a kind of double voicedness to my texts. There's always been different paths through the text, but I think that what I've found as time has gone on is that they're much more difficult for most Mormons to process than they are for other people. So I guess I'll just say that to start with.
Hello, how are you? All well, I hope? I mean, I really don't care that much, but seems like a nice way to open up. Good gesture. I had no idea that we'd be speaking in this way, kind of letting you know who we are and why we're here. I'm not exactly certain why I'm here. It seemed like a good thing to do. It seemed like an interesting topic, interesting people to associate with, so I'm really all about who I associate with. And where I can get my picture taken. So that's as long as you keep firing away, I'll keep talking. My background is I grew up not a member of the church, not in Utah. I grew up in Washington State. And I went to a community church, a local community church outside of Spokane, Washington. I ended up going to Brigham Young on a non-member scholarship, and I'm not sure exactly what that means. I'm not sure exactly how I got it. There's a lot of questions I have for you, obviously. Hopefully we can get to the bottom of this. Why am I like I am? I believe it was a Mormon high school counselor who led me, some would say astray, some would say down the right path, holding firmly to, is it iron? I'm always an iron rod, isn't it? Yeah. Somebody had a rod is all I remember at this point. It's a little hazy, actually, what happened, and I just get it in flashbacks. But I'm perfectly fine. And so a scholarship arrived, and I took it, both for the fact that it was the best one that came my way, and also geographically was furthest away from my family. So I came to Brigham Young to study, and was really inundated, you know, in a good sense, if there's a good way to be inundated, with the culture and the religion. And I was wise enough to not take a dorm on campus. I remember even as a freshman, I took an apartment. In fact, one of my old roommates is here today, which is I either owe him money on the phone bill or it's just good to see him. I'm not sure. It could be both. But I thought, you know, the idea of hall prayer and all of that, I'm not exactly sure if that's something I want to do, but I'm curious. As I'm now bi-curious, I was BYU curious at the time. And so I started my education there, and I was duly educated. I was I joined the church under no duress. Are they listening? Because no, I mean the church. If they're listening, there was no duress. Yeah, you never know. That's the thing. Someone's listening. If it's only him upstairs. So I joined the church, and I finished my time at BYU, and I think I asked a lot of the right questions that anyone should ask as a student. I think the job, which has multiplied into the job that I have now as a writer, I think, is to ask questions. I think my business is to entertain and to teach occasionally, but it's I'm not sure what I said. But the idea is that as a student, I think you have to ask questions, and as a church member, you should ask questions. And as a writer, I certainly feel that's my job. Not to provide answers necessarily, because they're not always there. Or I don't ask that question knowing what the answer is. I try not to lead an audience to where I want them to go, so much as put it out there as a question and say, I'm really uncertain as to what the answer to this is, but it's a question that's worth asking. And so I felt like I did that as a student. Sometimes that was celebrated, actually never celebrated. Sometimes it was okay. Other times it was flat out bad. I then went on to graduate school a couple different places. I went to the University of Kansas. I went to NYU. I came back to Brigham Young to work on a PhD. And this is where a lot of the kind of falling out, if there was one, that happened. I did write or begin writing this play, Bash, which is essentially three short plays, and performed things at BYU. And at a certain point, was basically asked to just not do any more work. If that would be all right with me, could you just not work here? And found myself locked out of the theater, essentially. I actually was teaching a class at the time, so I had keys to the theater. And there was my last semester at BYU, I ended up rehearsing a play off campus, and the final was a three-hour period. And so I rushed the students through a final, through an hour final, which was quite simple, so that I would have 2 hours in which to perform a play. That still felt right to me. It still felt like I was asking the right questions. At a certain point, I made a movie or two that brought myself a wider sphere of recognition with an audience. Still continued to do theater, and it was in fact that play, Bash, which was done in New York and then subsequently Los Angeles and taped for Showtime, which came to the attention of church elders. And I was disfellowshipped not too long after that. And so that brought me to a place where, as I believe it is, a kind of limbo that says either you're going to go in one direction or go in another direction. I sort of floated. I'm a great procrastinator, as most writers are, but ultimately ended up resigning my membership from the church about a year ago, I think, finding that, certainly for my children, that it was better to have a father who wasn't a Mormon than who was what they essentially saw as a bad Mormon. And for a long time, I could reconcile the work I was doing, although that was the only work that I wrote that had anything to do with the Mormon culture, and mostly because I was lazy, frankly. Rather than researching any other church, I thought, I know this church, I can use this material. And it really wasn't about the church so much as people who I wanted to have seen under the general veil of goodness, who felt strong and supported within the framework of an organization like the church, and yet talk about essentially the fact that they're by no means safe, that because they're members of this church or any church, they're free from having to make human choices and make mistakes. And so that was the idea. Ultimately, it led to this disfellowshipment and then to my resignation from the church. But I continue to write whatever I see fit, I guess, ultimately. There's no subject when I was a member of the church or not that seems off the map to me. Everything is worth asking about or questioning. It's all about what you lay in the laps of the audience and what they'll accept, I guess. That is a kind of interesting bond that I'm interested in examining, in what, how far one can push an audience, how far you can push yourself into probing characters and plot. And what I've come back with is that what's most important to me is to be true to the characters. Once I've decided on what I'm going to write, then I have to see that through to the end, rather than worry about what an audience will feel about it. It's never enough love, is what I found. So, who cares about it? And you know, write what you want to write, and that's led me to the place that I'm at now, where I'm relatively comfortably working in the worlds of film and theater. Occasionally writing prose, not too often. I had a collection of stories about a year or two ago, but that's certainly not my main focus. But I like to write. I like to write and continue to ask the questions, the harder questions. Unfortunately, I like to ask the harder questions of these fictitious people rather than asking the questions to myself. It's much easier to be brave on paper, I find. And so it's, you know, that's something that I've reconciled more and more with. It was very easy to self-justify for a long time, but at some point both those worlds that I'd created didn't crash down, but they came very uncomfortably close together, to where I had to ask the questions that other people had already been asking of me and that I had brushed off, which were, how can you continue to be a member of that organization, which has very clearly delineated senses of what art is and should be, and you create, for instance, if we're advised not to see R-rated films, how can you then make R-rated films? And I said, well, you know, I'm never actually watching them. So... and how did you know that they were R-rated? Was the big follow-up question. But ultimately, those questions, as I say, were worth asking, but directed back to myself. And what I came back with was that I couldn't. I couldn't do both of those things. And I was much more comfortable as a person and as the glowing man you see before you, having kind of rectified that and being able to write what not just what I see fit, but what I find myself compelled to write, at the cost sometimes of family, friends, and others. But it's hey, it's a living. It's a living. So that's where we'll leave it now.
Well, in case you haven't noticed, the best writers all have full beards. A lot of you have been curious as to what this my new look is all about, asking me if I'm getting ready for a part or something like that. But actually, President Hinckley is very concerned that Mormons are all starting to look like a bunch of clones, so he's asked me to grow my hair and my beard out as long as I can and to occasionally swear in public. So. So I'm under orders. Okay. Somebody out there really believes that, so. Okay, I'm going to, first of all, I'm just tickled to death to be here. These two gentlemen, actually these three gentlemen here at my side are men that I think a lot of and that I've been watching over the years in their struggles, in their writings, in their work, and watching with interest and affection, even though I don't know them very well. So I'm just delighted to be here, and I want to hear more from them, so I'll try to make my comments as quick as I can. Thanks for the Frank Capra reference. I guess that's good. I love Frank Capra. It's a Wonderful Life's right there with Jaws as my two favorite movies. So, in fact, when my wife Gwen saw Brigham City the first time, the final cut, she goes, well, that's just exactly the kind of movie that a guy who loves those two movies would make, because it kind of mashes them both together. But let me tell you, I also didn't grow up, at least in my early youth as a Latter-day Saint, I didn't know anything about Mormons until I was about 8 years old, and before that I was a member of my father's family was Baptist, my mother's family were Pentecostal, and we were pretty much active Pentecostals, and we'd go across the street from my grandparents' house to worship. And in that, it was a very conservative Pentecostal congregation, and so we weren't allowed to see movies that's probably not the right word. It was often preached from the pulpit that movies, dancing, television, all those things were transgressions. And so I didn't see a whole lot. And when my mom met this Mormon guy, businessman who came zipping through town and ran off with all of us, finally, suddenly, I could see movies. And so some of the earliest movies that I was exposed to, I went from no movies at all to suddenly going with Harold, my stepfather, to see double features of Dirty Harry and Magnum Force. And Jaws was one of the early films I saw. I was very impressed with it. So I always had this... I'll get to that in a minute. But here's a formative experience that I think about every now and again. It was one night, I'd already seen Magnum Force on TV, in the theaters. And I was sitting down one night watching it on television. My stepfather was there. And even though he took us to these movies, he'd often, as we'd walk out, he'd talk about how terrible it was that there was nudity or that there was violence or whatever. I didn't care. I was just loving it. I thought they were great movies. But we were watching Magnum Force on TV one night. And there's a scene, you probably don't even remember this movie, but there was a scene where there's a sniper who's going to shoot this lady who's in a pool, swimming in this pool, and he's up high on a building, and he's up there with his rifle. And I was, I was very aware, even at an early age, that this was a movie. This wasn't a real guy, and he wasn't really going to shoot some woman. But when he shot, and then you see this explosion of blood on her back as she's swimming through the water, and there's like this boom, and blood starts going through the pool, and I just went, cool. And my stepfather just about beat the hell out of me, so just because he thought, what kind of a sick human being am I raising? But I was trying to explain to him, it's like, no, I don't think it's cool that he shot this woman. It was like, that was the coolest effect I've ever seen. And that kind of continued. My experience at BYU was a little interesting because I went in, I wanted to make films from the beginning, and I remember they'd make you do these little 8mm movies, and you could do anything you wanted to, and just about everybody in the whole school was doing these date movies. Some guy falls in love with some girl, and they go on a date, and it's cookies, and it was just lame stuff, and I wasn't interested in that, so I thought, I wanted to really learn how to film a fight scene, so I decided to make this little story where we're at a railroad station and two workers get in a fight over a woman who's wearing a sexy dress, and they just slug it out, and then eventually the guy who's getting beaten, he just pulls out a gun and shoots the other guy in the head. And you're not as amused as I was by it, but it was great. I was learning how to shoot, how to make a punch look real, and I was just having a great time, and I did something, and I look at it now and I think, man, that's pretty bad. That's like a Hailstorm movie. But I took it to class and put it up in front of these other movies, and I got this strange reaction of just kind of everybody was quiet and kind of icky, and I didn't get dates for a couple weeks after that. And the instructor afterwards came to me, and because the next project I had to do, and the instructor came up and he was just like, Richard, why do you this is I did it once, it's like, he goes, the first thing he'd really seen from me, and he's saying, why do you feel the need to do something so violent, why something so dark? And it wasn't all that dark and violent because I wasn't good enough at it yet to do it right. And I didn't really have an answer because it took me off guard, and so I started to think about it, and the next project was due, and so and I'd met my soon-to-be wife by this time, and I was going through this, well, should I just do something, or should I? Anyway, basically what happened was, because of his comment, I stayed up late one night and wrote this little screenplay of a BYU professor whose wife discovers that he's having an affair with a student, and so they're meeting, it was called Interlude, and they were going to meet for lunch in this little secluded area. And she brought the basket, and I had her with a red coat, like Red Riding Hood, with the basket, and she sits down, and she's slicing the cheese and crackers with this long knife. Well, all right, about that long. And he's not in time, so she goes to find him, and she catches him kissing this girl, who happened to be in real life his sister, which made it especially transgressive. And everybody in school knew it, So, and then, so she goes back, and she's angry, and he comes, and they sit down, and eventually, she pulls the knife out and just stabs him to death. And I was so upset about the intrusion of this professor telling me to not be so violent or dark that I just went, all the way. I mean, the knife went in about, four times, and there's blood dripping off the knife and out of his mouth. And then after he was lying on the ground dying with blood coming out of his mouth, she leaned down and kisses him on the mouth. It was actually a fantastic moment. That time, he didn't say anything. And I got an A-. So off of that film, so I thought I'd learned some secret. But that was something that my cell phone's about to go off because I have this stupid Verizon cell phone that it'll vibrate, but then it'll just ring to tell me there's a message, which makes no sense to me. And Verizon says that's just the way it is. So at the theater, I can always sit on it, and nobody can hear it, but I can't sit on it here, so you just have to live with it. Okay, I'll blame it on Neil. It's his phone. So it was interesting. I was out here yesterday talking a little bit about the next film I'm making called Falling, or maybe I'll change the title. I was talking to John Charles Duffy, who's probably here, and he said something really fun to me because I was talking about how it was going to get me in trouble and how naughty it is, and he just kind of chuckled, and he goes, Richard, he goes, you think you're much more of a bad boy than you really are. And I like that. I like that comment. I think he's probably right. However, there's something that I do want to talk about, which is, this is a serious thing that we're talking about today, and the repercussions of doing work that sometimes you feel strongly about. You know, there can be, you know, great repercussions, as you've already heard, in the communities that we live and in our families and friends. And it's one of my first playwriting teachers at BYU. His name was Max Golightly. I loved the guy. And he said something one day that just terrified me. We were talking about plays, and I was working on a play at that time where I was trying to kind of delve into my early life with my father, who my early life wasn't very nice. So I was trying to figure out what would have happened to me if I'd continued to live in that environment. It was a, you know, darker, serious, kind of Eugene O'Neill kind of play. And I really listened to what he had to say because I respected him. And one time he said something in class, just to the class he was talking. People were, you know, it's the usual questions. Are you a Mormon artist? Are you an artist who's Mormon? You know, and this the same kind of questions that we're talking about today. And he said, just burned itself into my brain. He said, the first great Mormon writer is going to be excommunicated. And I remember just being really upset by that because I wanted someday to be a great Mormon writer. And I didn't want to be excommunicated, but it was disturbing. And I think he's probably been proven somewhat prophetic. So to me, the ironic thing about Mormonism is that it's instilled in me a great conviction and a desire, a conviction for truth. Truth is very important, and I recognize that's something that's been, I think, maybe something that's been given to me through my Mormon experience, and it's often the thing that I find that causes me to come in conflict with others from the community, because to me, wherever the creative process comes from, whatever you feel like you have to tell, whatever story you have to tell, for whatever reason, I know that I try to adhere to a standard of honesty, at least to myself, and doing the best I can, making something as true and as honest and as sincere as I can, and I believe that these gentlemen do also, and I find that it's strange to find that a commitment to truth is what can drive you out of the church. And I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Okay. Does anyone have a question they want to ask to get this ball rolling? If not, I have some. Yeah, come to the mic. I think it's on. It should be on.
Hello, testing.
Okay.
Neil, I have two questions for you. I really like Nurse Betty. I thought Renee Zellweger, that put her on the map, and it's the best work she's done. I think that one violent scene, you know what I'm talking about, probably was over the top. And I don't mind violence. The Godfather series was great. I think Justice for All is probably the best comedy drama ever, with Al Pacino and Norman Jewison directed that. This one, I think she was in a kind of a soap opera world, and this one act kind of pushed her over. But you could have done that by quick shot to the head. I thought that excessive violence and killing the guy didn't quite fit the rest of the texture of that comedy drama. That's my first question. Number two, explain to us...
Where's the question in that?
Well, did you have input in that, or was it the writer's main input to have that done, or was it a collaboration, or and do you think it was over the top? Would you have been more restrained or killed him differently if you had to do it over again? And number two, and more importantly, what got you in trouble by doing Bash? Can you explain why the church got upset and why you were, you know, taking a task for that? Thanks.
Sure. I think you're referring to maybe the scalping early in the film. No, that was on the page. The writers are responsible for that, so that I can deflect some of it to them. I wholly embraced it, thought it was something I hadn't seen before. To be fair, it was much more violent when I shot it, and I continued to pare it down. So imagine how distraught you'd be if you'd seen the whole thing. So this is really to say, you know, number yourself among the lucky who haven't seen the whole thing. No, I had no qualms. You know, that was something I did think about, because only from the sense that it was a tonal question. It was these characters who perpetrate the crime need to not be lovable, but they need to be. I'm never very interested in lovable so much as interesting, but they need to be in a place where they can actually win an audience back over in a way, because there's a certain sense of the plot that carries these two parallel stories, and one of them is one of these hitmen who are following Renee Zellweger's character, Betty, and ostensibly trying to kill her and get back some drugs, also becomes enamored with her. So to make that work, how far could one go, push someone toward violence, and then win the audience back over in a way, to letting them be funny at times, to let them be wistful about their career and about the possibility of love, that kind of thing. So it was a sense of balance, really, for me, is what tempered what you saw, not how much blood or violent act was perpetrated during that moment. Because I knew that the film worked on a creaky sort of premise, in a way. It's a little like a coconut dropping on Gilligan's head. There's the sense that someone watching an act can be so distraught, or made so distraught by it, that they go into a kind of emotional and mental fugue, and then actually believe they're somebody else, and that they're associating with other people who don't really exist. They exist in a TV world. So I didn't feel that the violence could be too small. That in fact, if I'd had my druthers, if that's still a word that we use today. It could have been even a little more violent for me. So that was a long-winded way of saying no. So no, I was fine. I was fine with that, and it could have taken a little more. In fact, in most everything I've done, there's been a couple of things cut out that I'm still to this day relatively unhappy with. Not, you know, I'm more like disgruntled. Not like, you know, go up into a tower and start shooting, but kind of just relatively unhappy about it, that I ever gave in and cut it, because I feel like ultimately I'm very collaborative and I'm a, you know, potentially good person, but I basically know better, and I shouldn't have listened, because I can still sense that material is worth keeping in the movie. But for various reasons, I made changes, and there they are. But I feel like the reasons that I say that material was necessary, it was important to me. And, you know, that's the beauty of something. You can watch it and feel the way, and I completely believe that you feel that that's true. But to me, it could have been something else. It could have been even stronger. In terms of the play, you wanted to know what about it?
Well, why it got you in so much trouble with church officials? Was there...
It was the fact, essentially, that it was about Mormon characters who had some connection to Mormonism, some relatively devout, and others who had just been connected to it in some way in their life. And all of these, the three plays, dealt with some sort of moral crisis, a moment where a person had to make a choice, and the choice they made was relatively negative. Two of them dealt with infanticide, and one dealt with a gay bashing. And I don't know that it was the material so much. I don't know, in fact, how much or how many members of the church court that I was in front of had actually read the play. What was important to them, and I understood this argument, was that their worry, beyond the sense of how they feel about art and what art should actually do, beyond that discourse, was the notion that this play might be the first time that somebody from the from anywhere, from the outside, might have contact with Mormonism. And not the play even itself, but the fact that an article that they held up for me as an example, I think it might have been from San Diego, a review of a local production, and there was the review of the play. But as a review, it didn't necessarily say review, it just had text, and people look at that as either a news story or whatever it is. You know, sometimes you don't take the time to read everything that's in the paper. And there's a photo, and then there's a banner headline that says Murderous Mormons. And those two words combined may be the first contact that somebody has with the church. So that position was hard for me to argue, that's while it's out of my hands, I'm essentially perpetrating that because of the work that I've written. And so I didn't really have any qualms about that approach. And when they ask, would you please refrain from, say, ever writing about Mormon characters, I said, that's fine, actually, because I really have very little interest. I tend to not pull from my own life. So I generate, you know, most everything from my imagination. And it would be relatively easy not to write about Mormon characters. And since I've left the church, I still have really no interest in. In fact, I even reworked Bash at one point because I felt like it was marginalizing the impact of the play. Because if all of the characters had a connection to Mormonism, that one could watch the play and say, oh, well, that's just how they behave then. They just have, you know, just don't get on their wrong side because they'll beat the shit out of you. So I thought that, you know, that's actually working against what I wanted to say, because it was really about, I used the specific example of Mormonism, but really I wanted to speak about the general sense of someone that the cradle of religion is no place of complete safety, that one living in the world still is confronted with real moral questions, and it's easy to falter, no matter whom you are. So that was what I was interested in. So I did a version of the play that really generalized the religious context of it, so that they were just people who seemed to be based in and steeped in some kind of, you know, more like the community church, say, that I grew up in. So those were the things. I hope that answered what you were asking for. Otherwise, it was a long thing to sit through.
Is the play on DVD at all?
It's played on Showtime, and it's been available on DVD. But mostly it was simply, you know, something that they hold and that they show from time to time. So I hope that answered your question.
Let's expand that first question about what limits you put on yourself in terms of the amount of gore and violence that you deal with in your works, and see if Brian or Richard want to just talk about how you decide how much violence you would have in a movie or a novel or a short story. Do you have any comments on that?
I think it's much more organic than that. I mean, I think it's hard to, I never sit down and say, all right, I need 10 pints of blood and, you know, a razor will be in this. But I think that the material dictates certain things to you about what works or what doesn't work, and you follow those, and I think I do some of the same things that Neil was talking about, where as I'm writing, I often will revise fairly heavily and pare things down till they're to the right point. And sometimes I'll expand them if I don't feel they're to the right point. So, yeah, I mean, for me, it's an organic enough process where everything is connected that it's very hard for me to separate out that one element from everything else. I think that one element is very much a part of the larger structure of the work.
Well, I find it difficult to respond to. I hear that kind of thing a lot. You know, did it have to be so? Did it have to be so jarring? Did it have to be so violent? Did it have to be so naughty? Did you have to show so much of her or it? And what I find interesting is, you know, there's an assumption on the part of some of that question that everybody's the same. I mean, you know, if we, no matter what we do in an audience like this, we'll put something up, and you know, some of you would be, you know, horrified by the way we might depict something, and others wouldn't be fazed at all. Everybody's at different levels. What I find interesting is I'm often criticized by people who really you know, first they'll tell me that they only see, you know, one, maybe one movie a year, and then start to talk to me about, you know, why am I, you know, does it have to be so, you know, usually I don't get the word violent, I get disturbing. And I kind of want to say, well, if you'd been watching anything since 1950, you know, you've got to recognize that we're trying to communicate something. We're trying to communicate an emotion or a thought. We're trying to get through to you. We're trying to have an effect. And so for me, yeah, I recognize that the audience is made up of all different kinds of people, and so I just try to do what I want to do. And the only time that I cut things back is because I work so independently, I don't have to deal with, you know, the studio nonsense and things like that, which I hope someday to have to deal with the studio nonsense. But where I come up against it's with the ratings board, with the MPAA, because both, you know, Brigham City was you know, I had to make cuts to get that to PG-13 because it was R, and then I had, with States of Grace, I had to make cuts to get that to PG-13 because that was R. And it becomes a really ridiculous process when you're sitting down, you know, talking about, you know, two more frames, which is, you know, what is that, 1/12 of a second on something, you know, then it, you can get away with being PG-13 instead of R. So it's a real strange place to be.
Is that for yourself then that you're hoping to get to an R since you're working so independently? I mean, to get to a PG-13?
Well, it's because of the film, because I recognize the economic necessity is, I mean, if I put Brigham City out as an R-rated film, I don't care personally. I mean, I don't care, but I recognize that that a large portion of the intended audience won't go see it. And so I got to take that balance and say, okay, is it going to, you know, taking out these frames, is that really going to affect the story, and is it going to be worth that much to me that I'm going to lose that part of the audience? But I'm asked quite frequently, you know, are you ever going to do an R-rated movie? And I always, you know, just, oh yeah, you bet, because to me, you know, that's part of the discussion that I want to just go away. I want us to just, you know, stop thinking about films in that way and just start thinking about, you know, not what's in, you know, not what's not in them. It's like people, we as a people, our community tend to judge our art by what's not in them. So if it doesn't have dirty words, if it doesn't have nudity, then it must be a good movie. Instead of concentrating on the fact that, well, if it has great characters, if it's got a great story, if it's wonderfully executed, then it's a good movie. That's my prime frustration, I think, in this community, is trying to educate people, trying to get people to see film as an art form instead of just as family home evening.
Great. Another question?
Yeah, I sure like to get involved in the movie discussion. You know, but I feel that as long as, you know, it's done contextually within the framework of the movie and adds to the movie, I think, you know, a lot of times, because I'm more concerned about the desensitization that's happening, and, you know, the fact that we can pop, you know, we can eat popcorn and pop candy in our mouth while heads are being blown off and say it's entertainment and so on. But if it's done contextually, my question is, as far as, you know, we're... Sometimes. So I can't stomach the news anymore, but... The true mavericks, you know, Peckinpah, for example, you know, that created the real genre of violence as far as how it's done in real art form, you know, with the Wild Bunch and Straw Dogs and so on. And I think we can count those on one hand nowadays. You know, everybody's going to have their own favorites. Scorsese, for one, is one that, you know, is able to do it well. David Lynch is one of my favorites. I can relate somewhat to Richard, you know, with my movie situation when I was younger, because, you know, so, I was raised on it.
Are you going to a question?
Yeah, I was just going to say that because it came to my mind that I was thinking about, you know, because I loved those kind of movies, a surreal kind of movie that, you know, that I loved Hitchcock, and my mom wouldn't let me go see Psycho, so I said I was going to go to a Disney movie, and I ducked into Psycho on Main Street here on the Utah Theater and got a chance to see it in 1960 and loved it. So ever since that, you know, I've had that love for movies. But I'm just wondering, you know, where's the real trendsetters now? That's my question. As far as the mavericks of the movies are concerned, like Lynch, like, of course, Scorsese, Kubrick, people like that that, you know, have no bounds as far as the studio is concerned and want to do the kind of movies they really want to do.
Oh, great. Let's take that. Who are the up-and-coming people who you guys watch and admire and like?
Do you want to answer that? I like all kinds of people, and sometimes it's just a single film that they've done that I think you couldn't rule out whether you like them or not, because it's dangerous, you know, when you stand up and say, not dangerous, like, you know, something's going to happen to you, but there are absolutely people out there who, the people that you mentioned, that they would have very little worth to an audience. You know, there are folks who don't like David Lynch. There are people who don't care for Scorsese or Peckinpah or Kubrick, for that matter. And I don't think that they're wrong in the sense that it's a very subjective medium. You know, art itself is a very subjective thing. I probably tend to agree with you in terms of the people that you talk about, but I try to afford people that sensitivity and sensibility of that they may like something else. So I may, you know, I look at somebody like Gaspar Noé, who is certainly would, you know, you can argue both ways about how you feel about his work, but he's certainly pushing the envelope in terms of violence and what, you know, the way in which a story can be told. There's a lot of interesting European filmmakers. There's interesting filmmakers in the States. I think someone like Paul Thomas Anderson is really interesting, you know, and I think. I did sit through. I wouldn't talk about it if I hadn't sat through it. Yes, I was able to sit through it. I'm sorry?
I say it was walked out on Cannes Film Festival.
Well, certainly not by everybody. People did walk out. Many people have people walk
very
out in Cannes. Sorry?
Strong
is not a bad word to me. I mean, it's not a negative or a positive. It's just strong. So there's a lot of people out there that think that are making interesting pictures and doing them, you know, with a small amount of money sometimes. So, I think the good news is that people are accepting. Lars von Trier, I think, is continuing to push the envelope of what is acceptable to a wider audience. As he dealt very strongly, I'll use your word, with race in Manderley, whether you liked it or not. You know, whether, you know, a word as loaded as the word nigger is acceptable in a movie theater today, probably more acceptable here, but it's, you know, it's always a question of kind of where you're at and who you are and where you find yourself in terms of what you are interested in or how effective you think someone takes those ideas and puts them on the screen. So I'm very hopeful that, you know, that the kind of work that you're talking about and the kind of work that I'm interested in will continue to be made. People will continue to push the boundaries of what makes up, you know, cinema. Whether it's good or bad is another thing. But I think there are the good news is that people are more and more accepting of various kinds of formats in which, you know, people are more accepting of watching something that's been shot on video. You have Michael Mann now putting out a film like Miami Vice, which is shot on video. And you can find people who are making films for $10,000 that are shot. It really doesn't, to me, it's all about, you know, the content. If there's probably no more arresting film in the last maybe 10 years than The Celebration was, Thomas Vinterberg's film. And you can either look at that and say, God, it looks like hell, or you think, wow, it's really sort of beautiful. Honestly, it really comes down to perception, I guess. So I'm not exactly sure who, you know, it would be different for me than for you, who, you know, is out there making those kinds of films. But I think the good news is people are out there making more and more films that are you know, interesting.
So yeah, I agree with that there is this difficulty that everybody's at a different point in terms of what they're willing to watch or what they can take. Last time I was at Sunstone, I was on a panel that was talking about Altman's Tongue, my first book, and there was a woman on the panel who had read the book and then began to weep just because it was too much for her to take and too much for her to even talk about. And, you know, that's something that I can respect. You know, everybody's at a different point. Everybody has a different approach to things, and so it is hard to sort those things out. Gaspar Noé is someone who I actually like a great deal as well. He has another movie called I Stand Alone, which is a very, very difficult film. I think much more difficult in some ways than Irreversible, which is also an amazing movie. And then I think about people. There's a little Japanese film called Addition that does things with kind of psychosexual violence that are quite disturbing and quite absurd at the same time. He takes a kind of romance story, and it's Takashi Miike, who's done a number of movies that are all very strange movies. He takes a romance story, and then it slowly erodes itself away as it goes along. One thing that I'm interested in as a writer is people who take forms that we've become used to or we've become complacent with and start to take them apart. And I think for film as well, those are some of the things I look for. But it really depends on who you are and what your background is and what you've seen already. And there's a lot of different things that go into making one film work for a person or one book work for a person and not work for another person. I do think it's a mistake, ultimately, to try to make the incredibly inclusive film or try to write the incredibly inclusive book that everyone is going to read and like, mainly because I think you end up with something that really has very little power to it. It ends up being like a very bad cookie that has no taste to it, but that you eat just because it's there to eat. So,
what frustrates me is finding in the independent world when somebody comes out with some interesting new voice or approach or some filmmaker who has something to say and is committed to the art, and then you have to wait a long time in between their films, and then usually they only make a few and then they're gone and they're teaching at some university somewhere because the marketplace isn't very friendly to that kind of filmmaking. So, but I think a lot's going on that we don't give credit for. There's a magic in time passing where now, we look back and we talk about, Sam Peckinpah, and et cetera, et cetera. At the time, of course, Sam Peckinpah was alive and working, and so it was easy to say, his stuff is horrible and he's ashamed to the cinema and all that kind of thing. And of course now with time we can look back and go, no, he was a genius, he was wonderful. And there's lots of those. I don't really worry about that because I know that some of the films that we're not even paying all that much attention to today, 15 years from now, we're going to be talking about, and we're going to be thinking about how wonderful they were and talking about how we discovered them and we knew it all along when in fact we really didn't.
Great. Question?
Thank you, gentlemen, for appearing here today. It's great. I admire your work. I wanted 2 years to ask Mr. Dutcher this question. My son and I are huge fans of Brigham City, and we find the climax stunning. And to think that it's basically two talking heads across a table for about 8 minutes, shot with two cameras, I guess. The only thing escalating, it seems to be the discussion and the assembly of the gun. Did you know it was going to work? Did you kind of go, well, it's just two people talking, and it's the climax of the film? How'd that come to you? How'd you get brave enough to pull it off?
Well, that's fun. I remember writing it because I was at my computer and I was working on it, and I became so excited when I realized how I wanted to play the scene, because it was like I knew what had to be said, but I needed something in order to make it work. And when I came upon the idea of him assembling this gun and letting that tension mount as they were talking, I remember just like jumping up and down, like, oh, this is going to be fantastic. And I think that's something that I think comes, that we're talking about when we get into issues of should you show this or should you not show that. I mean, there's such that creative act of coming up with something and being so, there's a real delight to it. You're just like, oh, this is, you want to share this with somebody. You want to have an effect on somebody. You want to get them beside you in your brand new Porsche and take them for a spin and scare the hell out of them. I don't have a Porsche, by the way. I'm just trying to communicate this idea of wanting to, having gone on this ride and you want to grab other people and say, come on this ride and do it with me. And then the idea that someone would come in afterwards and say, you know what, that loop on this roller coaster that you've made, some old ladies are really going to hate that, and so you better lessen that. In fact, let's take the loop out altogether or whatever. I know I'm kind of jumping back to an earlier subject, but yeah, I mean, you do, and I think that's one of the joys, Neil, probably, and someday when you make a film out of your own book, which I'm hoping for, when, there's that joy when you go from that conception to actually, delivering and then watching an audience, and you can still remember that day when you were sitting alone in your apartment, you had that idea, and there's just such an excitement there that's thrilling. So yeah, but it's always a challenge, and you're always terrified that it's not going to work. In fact, we started shooting that scene, and the actor Matthew, a good friend of mine, he just wasn't getting it. And I was terrified because our time was running out and it wasn't really working. And so there was a whole adventure there of racing against the clock to find just the right delivery and just the right move. So yeah, I knew that it could work. I didn't know that it would work, and I was glad that it did.
I'd like to ask a question of Neil and then of Richard. The Times piece on Sunday that talked about your next project, The Wicker Man, a remake of a very unusual and still unusual film years after it was made. I'm not recalling now if it said that you're also doing the screenplay. Are you doing the screenplay for the new film? Yeah. Okay. Question is, doing a remake of a film that was regarded at the time as being extremely original and unusual, how can you, I understand you're shifting the setting to the Northwest, is that correct? Mm-hmm. And were you attracted to the project because of the risk of taking on a film that was both little known to a widescreen, mass screen audience, and yet highly praised for its originality and giving it a whole new spin in a different way? Was that the attraction? I suppose that's my question for you. What I'd like to ask Richard is, the Joseph Smith project, is it still alive, and if and will it be made sometime by you? And from what you say and what I know about you, I assume it will be would be a portrait of Joseph Smith that would not be simply simplistic, but would take in the whole aspect of his personality, which will be, seems to me, a hell of a risk in all kinds of ways. And what do you anticipate about how you're going to play that? Thank you.
Yes, is my answer. Yeah, of course. You, when there's source material, if it's a novel, you know you're beholden to someone who that is particularly dear to, the author, and then people. I went through the same kind of thing working on Possession, which was a well-regarded novel, Booker Prize-winning novel. And in some ways, it's even more difficult because there's such a wealth of material, and you come to it as a fan, and yet you know there's great amounts of it you're going to strip away, that you're going to lose characters and incidents that you love, but you can't possibly get them into a two-hour film. So you have to be willing to be respectful to the material, but know that you, like a child leaving home, it's time to go, and you're going to forge your own way. And I think that same, I don't know whether that bolstered me, because I'd done that, and I'd certainly adapted things in the theater. So if it gave me any sense of, I can do this. But I think that knowing that film is as you mentioned, either kind of beloved in a cultish way by certain people, particularly in the UK, and less so here, or not known at all. It's a title that means nothing to many people. There's still people I feel beholden to, because I think Anthony Schaffer wrote a great script, and I think Robin Hardy did a creditable job. I don't love the way it's directed, but it is when I saw it, when it was released in the States, it was, it is a singular experience. There's nothing quite like it. It gets lumped into the horror genre, but it's as described by Schaffer himself at one time, it's almost an anti-horror film. It does everything it can to defy expectation. And I tried to do that same thing, but I knew that I was taking the material in a very different way. It wasn't a shot-for-shot remake. It wasn't taking the screenplay and updating it. It was really an interest in, I know where I want to go, but I'm going to get there in a very different way. I knew the ending was important. That was one of the, when people really distill what they like about that film, the police procedural elements are interesting, but the ending is really the thing that seems to wow people. They like the environment that's created, the idea of that it's really at the heart of it is about fanaticism and this Christian versus pagan struggle. But I think they love what happened in the ending. So it was important to all of us who were involved to maintain that. And in a way, that's one of the most expected things people think we're going to fuck up. They think, oh, you got a movie star, you're being distributed through Warner Brothers, you're going to mess that up. You're just going to ruin, you know, somehow something bad, meaning you're going to ruin what essentially was bad in the beginning. So we've tried to be very true to that, but the way in which we get there is quite different, and that's what drew me to doing it, and I think that's what drew those producers to me participating. They knew that I would take it somewhere else. So I had, again, no qualms about saying, and part of that is perhaps coming from the theater, you know, having people do various productions of my own work. I see all, it doesn't touch the original play. It is a you know, a piece of literature, but it's meant to be produced, and people do it to varying degrees of success. But I see that happen all the time. And I think about directing other people's plays or directing a classic. You know, I think about directing Hamlet or Tartuffe, and why should I? So many people have already done it. But what is my particular take going to be? So while I can understand where somebody might be worried about, you know, having their film remade, it never really bothered me. It was not a concern so much as I knew that I was going to create a very different version. It was a complete kind of reimagining of what existed. So I went into it fully aware of what the pitfalls might be, but happy to be involved in that material. And I really, frankly, am waiting for Richard to finish the Joseph Smith film so that I can remake it. So we'll see what comes of that.
Actually, I was going to ask you if you'd mind playing Hiram. No. Yeah, the Joseph Smith film, no, it's never dead. It isn't. It's been a real difficult journey, and someday I'm actually, you know, it's going to be a great book, the making of this movie, because there's so much stuff going that has gone on behind the scenes over the past few years that, oh my gosh, you're going to... That'll be as entertaining as the movie's going to be. So yes, I'm going to do it. And I get that question a lot. So and what I always say is, as long as I'm walking around, that movie's going to be made at some point. And I probably shouldn't say that, because there are a lot of people that don't want me to make it. So a bus might come my way someday if I publicize that too much. But no, I'll never give up on that. I'm very, very determined that, you know, come hell or high water, I'm going to make that film, and I'm going to do it the way that I want to do it. And I don't give a damn whether anybody likes it or not. I'm just going to, you know, can you tell I'm a little stubborn about it? Yeah, it will be made. I can't tell you when, but I'm hoping soon. So,
question?
Hi. By the way, thank you for Bash and Possession. I was wondering, the book where they dig up President Benson's body and they hang it up on the wire and try. I'm never going to forget that, but I'm never going to read it again. So I was wondering, when you're planning, and I understand like the delight of creating the effect, because it is really part of the wonder of seeing it and the punch it gives to the effect of the art. Oh, gosh, inarticulate. Anyway, I was wondering, do you think of it in terms of a single use item, the movie or the book, when you do something that's really graphic or strong?
I think that what happens with the work of art, if it's done in certain ways, is that it changes as you look at it again. I think that what happens with that, the story you're talking about, which is about a guy who decides that he has to save the church by digging up Ezra Taft Benson's body and trying to bring it back to life so that he can run the church again since we're lost. Ends up, you know, the first time you read that, I think what you really focus on is just the grotesqueness of the images and the way in which he talks about the body and just the whole process of digging it up and then trying to bring it back to life by galvanizing it with electricity. But I think if you read it a second time, then you begin to notice other things. And hopefully it's not that those things go away, but you start to see other things come out. And that is, I mean, I think that with work that feels transgressive or that feels challenging, you often have a multivalent response to it. And many people will read it once and gain a great deal from that one reading and let it go. other people will be able to go back to it. And you know when you should go back or when you shouldn't. And you may, you know, if you don't feel like you want to go back, you shouldn't. But other people will be able to go back into it and then take another path through it. So, you want to answer about film? Or
I'm not sure who that was. It was geared at Brian? My work here is done.
Brian, I want to follow up on that with you. You deal with Mormon content in so many different stories and novels. Is that just because you're writing about something you know, or are you like dealing with Mormon dealings, demons inside of you, some psychological thing that you're working through?
I actually think only about a third of myself deals very explicitly with Mormon. A third of my stories, probably a third of myself as well, but deals very explicitly with Mormon content, and then a lot of other stuff goes in very different directions. A lot of my work deals with religion in some way or another, and religion is a kind of power structure, and I think that has to do with the kind of interest in authority and the way in which authority works, and it has a lot to do with a long-standing interest in the relationship of the individual to the community, and the way in which we are either coerced by our communities or stand up against them or somehow find a way to be ourselves within a structure that sometimes doesn't want us to be ourselves. Having said that, I talked a little this morning about how, like Neil, I made a choice at a certain point to have my name stricken from the records of the church. I did that because I wanted to get enough of a distance because I was beginning to feel that being Mormon and having a kind of constant slight pressure from church officials was having an effect on my art that I wasn't for. It was once I, Altman's Tongue really has very little that's identifiably Mormon about it, but paradoxically that's the book that's the best known in Utah because of the controversy that surrounded it when I was because of the response to it. But once I left Utah, when I realized I'd need to leave BYU because of otherwise I'd be likely to be kicked out, I found that I did begin to write some Mormon stories. And it was partly being in a different place gave me a different perspective on Mormonism, and it was a perspective I was interested in. But, you know, I also, once I was in Oklahoma, wrote stories about Oklahoma culture, and realize that it's very similar in some regards. So I think what Neil was saying earlier about Mormonism in Bash being a kind of shorthand for religion and what religion does and how religion doesn't necessarily always protect us from making difficult decisions is true of my work as well. Often when the Mormon elements are there, I think it's a shorthand for what I see going on in other aspects of the culture as well.
I apologize, I'm not familiar with Brian's work, but I have specific questions for both Richard and Neil. Richard, I wanted to ask you about the experience of creating, I guess, the script and the film for Brigham City, and also its reception. And I'm wondering specifically about two elements, the kind of risk that you felt that you were taking, and then how these elements were received by your audience and the kind of feedback you got. And I'm really wondering whether you felt like it was more problematic to kind of demystify the figure of Bishop as inspired protector of the flock, or the depiction of an ordinance, because I mean, you've probably heard a lot more feedback on the film than I have, but that tends to be the things that people are kind of struggle with the film. And my question for Neil is, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the impact that your Brigham Young University experience had on your depiction of the college in Shape of Things.
No, I wasn't trying to demystify the bishop thing. I mean, I was responding to a reality that I saw around me that I lived with, that clearly good men, even the best men, are very fallible, make mistakes and fall short, and even with the best intentions can cause great damage. So I was very interested in that. I was also interested in just the theme of forgiveness. You know, it's like even something that I think is in short supply in our culture, not necessarily Mormon culture, but in American culture in general, perhaps world culture in general. But the depiction of ordinances, yeah, I left that behind me a long time ago. I struggled with it on God's Army, just about, you know, whether to, and at that time I thought I hadn't done it a lot, so, and of course it was a taboo and it was an unknown, and so I'd, you know, do things like, you know, shoot the way I could shoot it. I could do half the ordinance and then cut, and then I could shoot from the other angle and never have to actually physically do an ordinance. And in the process of doing that, I realized how ridiculous that was, and that it was, and at that point I just left it all behind me, and so now I have zero problems. I mean, I don't have any conflict because I realize that I don't have any, God's not mad at me for the way that I've done it, and at least I'm pretty confident that he's not. And I just feel like it's strange. You know, the thing that I've noticed is that the movie cinema, especially taking movies seriously in Mormon culture, is so new. In fact, it hasn't yet started yet in many ways, that some of the conversations that we have just, boy, it's, you know, having that conversation over and over and over again about whether it's right to show an ordinance, it's like, you know, it can go on forever. But for me, I just say I'm totally comfortable doing it. And in fact, I think it's necessary. And how do you depict Mormonism if you don't show what's unique to it? And you know, you've got to do it. And again, I think anything, any subject, any issue, any occurrence, anything that happens between human beings or anything that we can imagine happening between human beings is fair game. And I think it's our duty to explore that.
And your question was about how did my experience at BYU shape the college atmosphere of the shape of things? Was that a negative thing that you just said? Not necessarily. Yes, but not necessarily. No. Again, not something that I pulled from life. Didn't feel like I was ever manipulated in that way by someone that I went out with, or manipulated someone in that way. I certainly pulled from the college experience, but I had many of them. I had four of them, and also taught at a college. So I physically, in terms of what I was imagining for that play, was probably something closer to the environment at the University of Kansas, which is a very kind of quintessential, rather than say stereotypical, environment in terms of a what you could think of as a college town, a fairly liberal community on campus, and then a fairly conservative one surrounding you. So that was the idea that I was working with, that kind of thing. And in fact, Paul Rudd, who was in the original play in London and New York, and then was in the film, I met him at University of Kansas. So we kind of shared that idea as a place that we would pull from when we were creating it on stage. So experience always seeps into what you're doing. It ends up being a cocktail of things you've seen or thought and things you make up. It ultimately becomes whatever drink that it is by putting a little of this and that in. But there was no outright experience that I had, and certainly not at Brigham Young. I've seen probably more people in places that I didn't expect there to be the kinds of repression or difficulty with art. Say at NYU, I thought it would be quite a liberal community, and people would be very embracing of all kinds of work, and yet I found my work constantly under fire because people tended to be very militantly whatever they were, be it conservative, gay, Republican, what else is there? I think roughly those three things. So I often, you know, would run into conflict with a student or a professor about work. And I've seen, you know, just in the past year, students have a show closed in New York because of, you know, the use of what's deemed a public space and their work being questionable. So, you know, that's happening in New York and Cincinnati and all over. So I didn't find it any more difficult outside of the locked theater at Brigham Young. You know, there was some, and I always found ways around it. You know, when I was an undergraduate, I wanted to do a David Mamet play, Sexual Perversity in Chicago, and the title alone kind of held me back in terms of performing that at BYU. But what I found that I could do is I cut a lot of the language, you know, the sort of overt thing that people would find difficult. And I'm sure Mamet would shudder if he saw the cut that I did, but I was quite proud of it, you know, when I was young. And then what I did is my poster was written in such a Rococo language, you know, font, that you actually, if you passed it, you really couldn't read it. So I sort of, you know, publicized it without publicizing it. And, you know, so I sort of always flew. I was a bit of like a drug runner from Columbia to here, where I was always just flying under the radar most of the time. But that's a little bit off the path. Yes, it shaped my knowledge of what a college experience was, but no more than the other places that I went to school at or taught at.
This question is for Richard. I recently, earlier this year, saw States of Grace when it was shown at Trolley Square, and you were there and spoke to us then, and was very struck by it. It was a powerful film for me, particularly the theme of forgiveness. And I have wondered since then, because I've reflected on it quite a bit, what the response from the LDS community was to your film States of Grace.
Mostly silence. let's wait till DVD and borrow it from the neighbors. I have a theory, in fact. I feel like my films are getting better, which that's the idea, I guess. But what I've noticed is the better that the films get, the less money they make. So the next one's going to be really bad. And I have to do that in order to keep making films. So just so you know, coming in advance, Sean Means. I've been disappointed. It's been, obviously disappointed and depressed, actually, when I realized that perhaps this community is not going to be the community that will be able to support the kind of work that I want to do. In fact, it's rearranged my entire business model and how I'm going to do things, recognizing that I'm going to continue to do the kind of films I want to do, but I have to find a new way to do that, because my grand idea of this great Mormon community that would lift cinema to heights that have never been known before was incredibly naive, but fun for a couple of years to talk about. It was... mostly, you know, that's a question that'll probably be best after the DVD comes out and people actually see it, because right now it's, you know, some people know about it, but not a whole lot of people have seen it, so can't really say.
Well, how about in terms of general authorities?
General authorities? No, I haven't heard anything. So.
Yeah.
Actually, President Hinckley's asked that every Mormon family go see this movie 3 times.
Hey, Eric.
Well, I teach at BYU, and I can't help but notice the irony that all 3 of you have connections to BYU, either as students or as former faculty, and yet 2 of the 3 of you are essentially anathema there now, and the 3rd one will be when Falling comes out. all because you were presumed to have violated an aesthetic that is supposed to be Mormon. And yet, when I look at my students now who are interesting, the ones who look like they're going to be interesting, what I see is a tremendously difficult, painful process in which they see things that also are transgressive of that aesthetic and start to realize that that aesthetic no longer serves them. And in most cases, it would be a film of yours or Almond's Tongue, which is sort of the impetus for that. Well, they'll see something like In the Company of Men, and they'll say, that speaks to me, and the things I'm told I'm supposed to like don't. What was that process like for you? Did you find yourself doing that where you have to slough off, to a certain extent, aesthetic assumptions that you came to realize were no longer a value to you or no longer served your development as artists?
When I was about 14, my father gave me the basic Kafka, and at the time I was reading fantasy novels and I was reading science fiction novels, and that was about it. And that was something that really suddenly challenged my aesthetic, and I didn't really understand a lot of the book. But I knew it was doing something that I found strange and interesting, and so I kept on reading it. But I do remember a point when I was at Brigham Young as a freshman. I was in Eloise Bell's class, creative writing class, and we read a Raymond Carver story called Nobody Said Anything, which is about a boy who basically sits around and masturbates and then goes fishing, very flat stylistically. And when I read that story for the first time, it really did challenge me. It challenged me pretty dramatically. And I was disturbed by it. I didn't know what to think of it. And had a very hard time with it for a while, and you know, didn't know how to react. But finally, I just decided the thing to do was to let it sit for a few days and then reread it and then try to figure out something else about it. And as I did so, I think I started to teach myself how to read, and also how to process information that I found difficult. And so there was a sloughing off that took place. And for me, that was very much about being willing to open my eyes up pretty widely to any experience. I'm very much a strong believer that anything can serve you as an artist, that anything that you read or anything that you experience or that you watch can be for the good if it's taken in the right frame of mind or the right spirit. But that's something that it took a long time for, you know, it took a few experiences like the Carver experience for me to kind of reach a point where that made sense for me. And one thing I found at Brown, you have a lot of students who come from very good high schools where they've been taught to read modernism, and they read it kind of backwards and forwards really well, a very good sense of it. But that when you approach them with contemporary fiction, which asks for a kind of different approach to things, they're not prepared for it at all. So I don't think this is something that's exclusive to Mormonism. I think that there's a kind of process that we go through as our aesthetic develops. It's something that shifts and changes as we go along, and you know we the right things hopefully come along at the right moments for us.
Hey, Eric, how are you? Nice to see you. When I was about 14, my father picked up a copy of The Basic Kafka and hit me across the face with it and said, "Shut up, asshole." And that challenged my aesthetic. Not quite that, but it was an interesting upbringing, unique in its lack of interest in the arts. And I'm not quite sure where mine developed. In some sense, from my mom, because she always had a hopeful nature, and I think a healthy interest in the arts, although on a relatively simplistic and basic level, but always pushed me toward whatever things that I liked, that I should kind of wholeheartedly go toward them, and it happened to be literature and film and theater. I think it's a very singular experience that everybody makes, and I think you're quite right about it's not exclusive to Brigham Young. And there's a certain set of challenges that probably come to those students, as I felt like it came to me, and I felt certainly in the beginning, at the time that I knew you first, as a bit of an outsider. And actually, it was you that made me feel that, and I feel like I just publicly want to say that now. No, it's not true. It's you really did a piss poor job on me, and I'm coming down there, Mister. No, I felt quite welcome there, and I hope you knew, and I think you knew at the time. But it was, you know, you're always challenged in a new environment, and having such a kind of strong, well-publicized set of restrictions and guidelines, that's a challenge in and of itself. But I think if I'd been anywhere and having gone through a series of college experiences, I can say that I found some of them, even the one I described about NYU, more difficult, and I was probably more ready to be an individual at that time. But because my expectations were kind of geared towards an experience that I expected, I felt quite thwarted and put off by a lot of that experience. So I think it's able to happen anywhere, and sure, there's there's a readjustment, a recalibration all the way through of what our own set of standards are, what morals are, and there was an interesting class that what was her name? Swenson, Sharon Swenson taught, that was morals in film. And I was, for a brief period, I was a TA in there. It's where Aaron Eckhart and I met, and we always still laugh about it, wondering what the hell we were doing in there, and what the hell I was doing teaching it. But what was interesting to me in that class was not just the simplistic questions of would I ever appear nude? No, thankfully for all of you. The biggest question, but the, you know, not the most important question. But those kinds of questions, the insidious ones that take you at a kind of an artistic level and an economic level, and Richard jokes around about the idea of changing the kind of film he might make in order to stay economically, you know, viable, or make the other sorts of films that he wants. But people are faced with those decisions all the time, and they're sometimes public, sometimes very different than the ones you might face in your jobs or lives, but and yet oddly related. You know, we're faced with interesting ethical or moral, I get those confused. Probably because I have neither, so that's probably why I'm confused. But it's, you know, I think we're constantly faced, and if we think it's only going to happen when we're at the age that these kids are, we're fooling ourselves. You know, you'll be doing that throughout your life, and it's just a matter of finding that place where you're most, not just that you can go to sleep at night, because I think people can very easily find a place that lets them turn out the light and get to sleep, but it's often a very troubled sleep. And what interests me more is how do we ultimately live with ourselves? You know, how do we, if nobody sees us commit these crimes of a sort, are they okay? Is it, you know, what is it really? It comes back to some of the just the simplistic questions about good and bad and sin and faith, and that have always interested me, not as a Mormon so much as just as a person who grapples with them. You know, I guess what I'm saying is I still grapple with the same questions that I grappled with sitting in your class or teaching a class. Becoming a father, becoming, you know, a member of the church, not, you know, being in the church any longer. There's a constant series. Every day I go from being the best guy on earth, you know, to somebody who you give some money to, who asks for it out on the street, to being a son of a bitch to somebody that I forgot to call back today because I was busy doing something else. And I can be all those things in a single day. And so I think life will be a constant series of these tests and questions. And there's no good way around it, nor should there be. You know, it's good to be tested.
I want to make a comment on something Neil talked about earlier, and I'd heard recently. You it's of interest to me. I think it illustrates that. I mean, frankly, I can't imagine being in a group, being in a court situation and being told, you know, or asked, basically being told not to write about Mormonism anymore. I mean, to me, that feels like, I mean, it seems to express a real basic misunderstanding about art, you know, or, I mean, it's like.
It was a court of love.
It was a court of love.
Okay. That's a heart. I'm not hugging you.
But I just find I'm probably going to think about that for a few days because I just find that
the idea of me hugging all the men particularly.
But that idea that, you know, it's like I don't know how, even if you're not writing about Mormon, when it becomes such a part of your life, and Brian certainly, I mean, it certainly comes out in your work. I mean, the idea of thinking, you know,
well, the idea that you say that I know that I'm sure one day I'll direct an R-rated film. I can say, get ready for the hugs, because there is a point where you will be asked, not just, you know, questioned or sized, but you will probably face that those same questions, and you know, it's what you do with them and the decisions you make from there, because I'm sure it will be coming if you continue, you know, to foster even the general sense of where you want to go with your work, and that's not a good or bad thing. It's just what it is, and it'll be something that you'll deal with.
But you have to be ready for it.
You do, because there is a moment when they do, you know, present something like that, and you either say, you know, fuck you guys, sorry, I'm not going to abide by this, or you say, let me think about this, and you know, you, I mean, the way that I reacted to it then is probably different than the way I feel about it now. So it's, you know, it's again ever changing. You'll have some version of that face you, no doubt.
I'd like to. I'm kind of taking the question kind of thing, but if I'd like to know, kind of emotionally, what was going on with you when you had those experiences. You know, when you're in that kind of a position. I mean, I get a real sense that both of you are very much at peace at the, you know, with the decisions that you've made. And you feel like you've made the right decisions and the right decisions for you. But that must have been just, you know, absolute hell to go through those experiences.
It was very tough at the time. And for me, I talk about this in the afterward, to Altman's Tongue, the paperback of that. Led to the collapse of my marriage. I was married to someone who was Mormon, and as the church put on more pressure and I decided I had to leave the church, I realized that what that meant was it was essentially acknowledging the end of the marriage. So that was terrible to go through in some regards. But at the same time, I felt that it was also necessary. And different steps of the process had different combinations of that. I think if I would have been asked at the very beginning, as with the first objection of Altman's Tongue, would you, you know, are you willing to sacrifice things, other things that are close to you for the sake of your art, I would have said no. But I think as time went on and things built up and I kind of could prepare myself for what potentially could happen, it really made me think very seriously about what I was doing, and it made me realize what was important to me. And it made me prepared to make the choices I had to make when the choices came up. And those choices were all difficult choices to make, but I haven't regretted the decisions I've made. And I think, like Neil, there was a period where I felt like I was on my way out of the church, but it took a long time for me to, it's much easier to kind of be in a position where you're kind of in and not in at the same time. It takes a while before you get to the point where you decide, well, all right, I need this real separation. I need this kind of permanent separation.
Yeah, I feel like I've talked somewhat about that experience. And yes, it is difficult. It's but many experiences are in your life, and you face them or you don't. There were times where I didn't face them. Would even perpetrate lies so that I could continue doing the work that I wanted to do and not try and reconcile those two worlds. Those were some of the more difficult times, rather than being faced with, now make a decision, what are you going to do? I've certainly hurt people along the way, and there are other people always involved at a certain age and place in life. Those things you tend to feel the most regret about, and yet how much regret do I actually feel, because I'm still here in front of you doing the kind of work that I do. I've made choices and continue to make those choices. So I tend to feel relatively at ease and at peace with myself, but I'm, you know, frankly relatively easy on myself. So thank God I'm me. I'm doing okay with it. But it doesn't go away. Because you make a decision, because I'm not a member of the church any longer, that doesn't mean I'm still not faced with those questions, and the people who remained a part of the church don't still have those questions about me, and they're close to you, and so you have to continually ask them. So it continues to be a road that's not so much difficult as challenging.
And on those dark notes, we've come to the conclusion of this session. Thank you, everyone, and thank you, our panelists.